Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the singer Alfie Beau. The power and purity of his voice have been enjoyed by audiences from the Royal Opera House to Broadway. And if Cameron McIntosh is looking for a good tale for his next West End smash, he need look no further than the story of my castaway's life to date. One of nine children born in Blackpool, he left school at 15, worked as a mechanic before being talent spotted by a big-time director who whisked him away to perform La Bohème in New York, where he fell in love. Since then, hit records and sell-out concerts have been the order of the day. But, he says, you've got to remember to keep a sense of proportion about the whole thing. We're just singing songs. We're not going to change the world. Well, maybe not, Alfie Beau, but certainly your world has changed a lot. I'm wondering that when you sing, as you often do, The Impossible Dream, yeah, it must hold a special resonance for you.
It does. I mean, singing is such a wonderful gift to have. And when I first started to sing, at the age of 14, I didn't think that it was really anything I could make a living at, you know.
Yeah.
Growing up as a kid in Lancashire, you're told to either become a fisherman or join the army or something like that, you know, and so you don't really have the options of studying music or using an ability, using a talent. No, I do look every day at what I'm doing and think, I'm so lucky.
One of the very distinctive things about your working life, as I said just a moment ago, is that, you know, to sing at the great opera houses, the Royal Opera House and so on, English National Opera, Welsh Opera, and then to go on to Broadway and the West End, there are maybe a very few performers who've tried it, and it has to be said, most of them have come a cropper. You haven't. You've done it very successfully. Do you feel there's a degree of schizophrenia in your working life?
I think, yeah, it's. I'm very fortunate to have been able to, for the sake of using the word crossover, to a degree, you know.
I mean, it's a bit of a dirty word, isn't it?
It is,
a crossover artist.
To be honest, I see crossover in a different way than a lot of people do. I don't see it as crossing over the repertoire. I see it as crossing over the audiences to different audiences. It's not the grandeur of the building or the amount of people that it holds. You know, it's the actual people that are in there that count, you know.
It's interesting you mention the audiences. There was one critic, I think it was an opera critic, who said, your downfall would be your fans.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? What was he getting at?
I think, you know, he's obviously a purist when it came to music. And I just finished performing Les Miserables at the O2 Arena for the 25th anniversary. I think 2 days later I had to start rehearsals for Romeo and Juliet at the Royal Opera House.
Right.
This guy was sat reviewing the show and obviously didn't like the reaction that I got from the fans that had joined me from the Les Mis audience, you know, so...
What were they doing that was...
They just cheered and took photographs, and as I went out to take my bow, so I think the purists out there didn't like that. But, you know, I'm not bothered really about that. The fact is that I pleased my audience.
Well, I think you're going to please a lot of people with your musical choices. Really diverse, really interesting, but not any high opera.
No, no, no.
Why is that?
You know, I never go to the opera. I can admit this now, but I never go to... As soon as I'm on a desert island, I can actually say I never go to the opera.
You can easily say that.
I don't know. I go there and I feel very uncomfy. I just feel like it's not my world. When I'm up there doing it, that's my world. That's what I really enjoy. But sitting in the audience and watching it, I'm bored stiff. I really have to say that, I really am. I could sit at home and listen to it on record and really appreciate the old classic singers, but when I go there, it's just not my world. It's not my world.
As honest an explanation as I think I'm ever going to get from a castaway. And so, let's go to the first track then. Tell me who it is and why you've chosen it.
I'm a huge, huge fan of this guy. He actually inspired me to discover different styles of music and the history of folk music. So this is somebody that I really admire, and this is Bob Dylan.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore.
too dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
That was Bob Dylan and Knocking on Heaven's Door. I'm wondering, Alfie Bo, can you remember the first time that you sang?
I think I was about 8 or 9. And I remember singing Mull of Kintyre.
That would have been number one, wasn't it?
It would have been about then, yeah, yeah. With a cowboy hat on, a tennis racket in my hands and my clogs. You know, I looked a right sight, you know.
And what about the first time you sang in front of an audience?
In front of an audience, I was 14 years old. I did a Songs from the Shoals production in my hometown in Fleetwood. All I had to do was sing one line, literally 5 seconds. In fact, I think I was sick at the back of the stage before I had to walk down and make my entrance to sing the line.
How are the nerves these days?
Oh, they're all right. They're okay. I'm nervous today, obviously.
What are you nervous about?
Well, I don't know. I do get nervous about speaking in general. I could sing the whole programme for you. But,
you can if you want.
Speaking's another thing, you know.
Now, you performed at the O2 last year. It was the 25th anniversary of Les Mis, and it was 2 huge sell-out performances there. How many people were you playing to each night?
For the 2 performances, there was about 19,000 each show.
Ooh.
So, yeah, it was a good old crowd.
Now, of course, you have the entire cast supporting you.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
What's it like to walk out in front of 19,000 people who've paid good money to see you and expect the performance of your lifetime?
Surprisingly, because I'd played the role in the theatre, I knew what I had to do for the character. I knew what I had to do musically and all that. But I have to say, it was wonderful, you know, especially when I'm doing a solo and I'm the only one on stage singing Bring Him Home.
Yeah,
I remember being locked into this little world that I never really experienced before when I was singing that song. And all I was thinking about was the words. I wasn't even thinking technically about the way I was singing. I was just thinking what I was saying, who I was speaking to, and communication, really. I just felt everybody coming with me on that little journey.
Yeah, because your performances are very... They hold a sort of particularly intimate spirit.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting to hear you describe it. It makes me wonder about Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah.
Just to remind people, he is, I said, you know, a famous director.
Yeah.
He was the big-time director who was going to stage La Bohème on Broadway, which in itself was unusual. And you went to audition. You gave very particular and literally individual performances
for
him.
Yeah.
Can you, the circumstances of that audition were also unusual.
They were. I was working at the Royal Opera House at the time, and I heard about the auditions. But the only time I could get to see him was while I was supposed to be watching Parsifal, a 5-hour opera at the Royal Opera House. It was part of the programme that I was on there to sit through these operas, and I used to sleep through most of them. I used to find an empty box, bring a pillow in from home, put it on the floor and go to sleep. That's so bad. I can't believe I just admitted that, but there you go. But in the interval, I think one of the intervals was about 45 minutes long, and I literally ran over Waterloo Bridge to this audition room, sang to Baz, just me and him, and then ran all the way back. I think he was the guy that actually taught me to bring people into my musical world, not to put
out
too
much.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I got a phone call that night asking me to go to New York to audition for it again, and so I made the trip, sang to him, and then got the job that night.
Much more to come. Let's have some more music then.
Okay.
Your second piece is what?
This is my theme tune. this is about as classical as my list goes, I think. It's a theme tune to The Magnificent Seven by Elmer Bernstein. And I've always fancied myself as a cowboy. And this is the...
You got the shirt on today.
I have, there you go, you see.
Nice.
This is the anthem for every
denim shirt,
wannabe
nice
cowboy.
was the theme to The Magnificent Seven, composed by Elmer Bernstein. So as you said, Alfie Poe, you were brought up in Fleetwoods,
yeah,
in Lancashire. One of nine children, as
yeah,
I said.
Yeah.
So busy house then.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, we always had a lively household, good parties, good Christmases.
Where did you sit in the composition
in
the family?
I'm the youngest of nine.
Oh, yeah. You're the youngest
yeah,
of nine.
I've got five sisters and three brothers, and I'm
right.
the youngest.
But how old was the eldest? Sort of 20 years older
yeah,
than
my
you?
Eldest was 20 years older than me when I was born. I think, yeah, I had five sisters or six mothers, whichever way you want to look at it. But yeah, so they all did take care of me. And my brothers had left home by then as well.
And your mother originally planned to be a nun, so she obviously
yeah.
changed her mind.
Yeah, what she did. She had TB as a young child.
Right.
And so she was convalescing in a convent and she was going to be a nun. But she came home at one point and met my father. My father used to deliver groceries on his bike for the co-op, and he saw my mother walking down the street and just went ploughing into this wall, brick wall, just he was looking at it, all these cabbages and potatoes all over the road, you know, fell off his bike. And they were married for 47 years, yeah, before he passed away.
Right. And what sort of man was your father? I mean, I'm talking about as a young man at home with a big family.
Oh,
did you see much of him?
Yeah, I did. He was such a hands-on dad. He was a great fella. My first real education in music really was from my father, you know. He used to sing around the house, but he used to play a lot of really good singers, you know, and I think that's what I like, is I like good singers. I don't necessarily like one genre of music. I just like good voices, good singers and good songs. So he used to play Richard Tauber songs from back in the early 30s, you know. I used to play some folk, some country.
Did he have a good voice, your father?
He did have a good voice, yeah.
And you say it was a house where there was parties. did he get up and sing, was it?
He'd get up and sing. He'd get up and put the breadboard on the floor and do a clog dance on the breadboard. He'd then end up standing on his head after he'd had a few too many Guinness and that sort of thing. But, you know,
I wish I'd been at one of those parties.
It was good. Good fun.
Let's have some more music then. Disc number 3 it is now, Alfie.
Yeah, this is very close to my heart. This is actually a song that my father used to sing around the house all the time. Again, one of his favourite singers, Paul Robeson, and it's Mighty Like a Rose.
Sweetest little fellow, everybody knows. Don't know what to call him, but he's mighty like a rose. Looking at his mammy with eyes so shiny blue, make you think that heaven is coming close to you.
That was Paul Robeson and Mighty Like a Rose. You said during that, Alfie Bo, that your dad used to sing that to you a lot.
Yeah, he used to sing it to me all the time. I think I can actually even remember being held by him, you know, back when I was a child. You
right.
know, it was very emotional.
So a big, bustling household full of family and music
and
laughter
and
arguments and fights. Yeah, I was obviously coming on to that. Yeah, I mean, did you all sort of rubble? How big was the house?
It was a 4-bedroom council house. But, you know, my brothers and sisters, some of my brothers had left home when I was born and
right.
growing up. But no, we always used to have to share rooms and fight for the top bunk, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, and the hand-me-downs, the clothes that you got passed down to, you know. And never suited my sister's dressing. That was the only problem.
And what did your dad do? What was his
My job? Father was a process worker for ICI, the chemical factory. But he was also very good at woodwork. One Christmas, after he'd retired, he spent probably the full year making toys for the grandkids, you know. I just remember the room just being full of these little wooden toys, trucks and dolls' houses, and
wow.
It was wonderful.
How many nieces and nephews, then, do you have now?
Oh, my word. I think there's 38, 39, something like that now. Many on the way as well.
And do your family, do your brothers and sisters come and watch you perform? Are they sort of part of your life now? And
They have their own worlds going on, and they have their own kids that they're bringing up, and so when they can, they do come and support. If I'm playing locally, they'll always come along, you know. Like Blackpool, I'll be playing later on in the year, and so they'll come to that. And
what about when there's somebody in a family, and it can be, you know, a sporting superstar, it can be a businessman, whatever it is, you know, they throw up the contrast in other people's lives. Has that been an area where you've sort of felt sometimes that your life is a very, very different life from the family you grew up with?
Yeah. I think just living in London does that, you know. It's a very different world than Fleetwood, Lancashire. I don't think really some of my brothers and sisters realise that, you know. They see the London life, the fast life, the being on stage, the this, that and the other, and the glitz and glamour a little bit, but it's not always like that. You know, you have to work really hard a little bit.
Well, they don't see it from the inside.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, they see it from the inside. Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear next?
This is a great song. This is A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
Yeah.
But I just think it's a fantastic collaboration and a perfect example of how McCartney, you know, Lennon and McCartney worked as a team.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph.
That was the Beatles and A Day in the Life. Can I just mention, I hope you don't mind, you did say to me during the music that we were talking about clogs and your father wearing clogs and dancing on the breadboard.
Yeah.
You went skating in clogs once.
Well, yeah.
Have you made that up?
No, it's true. It's true. My mum and dad took me to a Blackpool ice rink and they put me on the ice rink in my clogs when I was about five, you know, and I went skating and I got quickly kicked off, but you know.
Yes. Desert Island is the home of the regional stereotypes.
Exactly.
This is great. Yes, we're really playing up to that. When you were at school then, how had your school years been before it came to leaving school? Did you enjoy school?
I hated school. I really hated school. I didn't like it at all.
Because?
I never sang. I never had music sort of encouragement from school at all.
Why was that?
I don't know. I always wanted to take music as well as an option. But I wasn't allowed to do that because I couldn't play piano or guitar or a violin or a flute or anything like that. So I couldn't take music, but I could sing. So my life really started at 3:30 after I'd finished school.
And had you never sung in, for example, the church choir?
Not really, no. The first time I joined a choir or a musical society was when I was 14, because my sister was going to amateur dramatics. And she invited me along one weekend, and I turned up, and there was a local girl that I fancied for a while, you know, and wanted to go out with. So I kept going back every week, and then I got hooked on the singing.
Right. Did you feel like you'd connected with a bit of yourself that you didn't know was there?
Yeah, I discovered a hell of a lot. I really had, you know. I think my life had just started. And it was like some fire had ignited inside me, this little flame or something had just switched on.
Right.
And it's not gone out yet, so...
And being... You said life began at 3:30. What did you get up to from 3:30 onwards?
3:30, I'd go to my friends' houses and we had rock bands that I used to play the drums, but I still play the drums. 3:30, it was going... either playing football, hanging out on the beach, playing music with friends in bands.
Let's have some more music then, Alfie Bo. What's next?
This was the start of my rock interests, really, as a kid. I remember listening to The Wall. This song just inspires me to challenge anything that I, you know, take everything on board as a challenge and just do it to the best of my ability. This is Comfortably Numb by Pink Floyd.
That was Pink Floyd and Comfortably Numb. There is still quite a lot of the rocker in you. I mentioned you wearing this denim shirt today. And when you were at home, one of nine, mum and dad at home, did they let you play the drums at home?
They did. Well, the reason why I started playing the drums when I was probably about 12, I used to arrange pillows and cushions on my bed, you know, from like a high-sounding pillow to a low-sounding pillow.
Okay.
You know? So, and it, you know, and I used to just play these cushions like crazy. My father heard me upstairs, and he came upstairs and what's all that noise? And he looked around the door and he saw me hitting these cushions. About half an hour later, I had this call from downstairs from my dad saying, "Alf, come down, you're making too much noise, we're sick of it now." And he said, "Look, go in the front room, there's something in there, I want you to shift it out of there, it's in the way, and put it upstairs, it's something of yours." And I opened the front door and there was a drum kit.
Oh!
It was incredible.
That's the stuff that dreams are made of.
Yeah, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing. He really thought, if you've got something inside your talent like that, use it, do something with it. And he'd give you the tools to do that, you know.
And so you started singing in this sort of weekend group, and it was clear from that that you had this great voice. And yet, of course, you went out to get a job because you weren't staying on to do the exams, and you ended up at the TVR factory in Blackpool making those very distinctive little sports cars.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And in the legend of Alfie Bowe's life, they say that it was a man who heard you singing on the floor of the garage as you were polishing his car who said, you want to do something with that voice, boy. Is that in any way true, or has that been completely made up?
I got a lot of encouragement from my work colleagues. You know, I was in Amateur Operatic Society doing West Side Story at the time. So I used to sing the music around the factory. The guys used to hear me. Customers used to hear me. And then, this fella who was in the business in some form.
To show business in some way.
Yeah, basically said, there's a company in London auditioning for guys like you for the chorus. Somebody else told me about the audition as well, and I picked up the newspaper and saw the advertisement for it. I thought, well, there's three things telling me to go for this audition.
So you come to London. Had you been to London before?
Never been before, no.
And this is for the audition for the Doyley Cars
company? For the Doyley Cars, okay. And I walked in and I'd turned up in jeans and again, nothing's changed really, jeans and a lumberjack shirt, you know. So I was surrounded by all these other singers wearing three-piece suits and their hair was all tidy and nice. And I had long hair at the time. Well, I still have long hair. And I thought, what am I doing here? You know, I don't fit in here. And I sang the only song that I could sing, and it was the only song I knew at the time, which was You Are My Heart's Delight by Franz Lehár. So I was at home and got the phone call from the company manager, and he said, we'd like to offer you a place in our chorus. And, my heart just jumped, and my father was all over the place. He was in tears. He was running around the room, and it was great, lovely moment. And I packed in my job in the garage and went on the road with the Doyley cart.
Do you remember the conversation with your foreman or your gaffer or whatever? What did you say to him?
I remember going in with such delight because my foreman was a real idiot. Such delight. And he says, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to be a singer. He said, oh, you're stupid. You could have a career here. 90 quid a week, you know. Everybody at the factory, though, was so supportive. My own colleagues, they were wonderful guys.
I hope he's listening. Let's have some music, then. We're on disc six.
Disc six. This is, again, I'm a huge fan of this artist. It's Elvis Presley. He had a real intimate side to his voice, and he could sing a lullaby just as sweetly as he could sing a ballad or a rock song. And this is called Big Boots, and it's from the G.I. Blues album.
They call your daddy Big Boots. Big Boots is his name. It takes a big man to wear big boots. That's your daddy's claim to fame. They know your daddy Big Boots wherever soldiers are, 'cause he can handle an armored tank.
That was Elvis Presley and Big Boots from the soundtrack to G.I. Blues. So, Alfie Bowe, tell me about going to the Royal College of Music then. You won a scholarship there.
Yeah, I did.
What age were you then?
I was 21, I think, 20, when I joined the Royal College of Music.
Did you feel like a real fish out of water?
I did, yeah. I went to the Royal College of Music not being able to read music at all. I think it's quite scary to walk through those doors and you see that building, it looks like Dracula's castle, you know. I didn't really know how I would get on without knowing music, without understanding music, because I'd learned everything in the past by ear.
Yes.
You know, and I still do that now. I rely on that. Even though I can read music, I still revert back to my old method of learning, which is just memory.
And how does that work then in rehearsals and so on? As you say, you do have the knowledge and you understand the craft, but if at the core of your personality is that person who thinks it's not really where I'm coming from, does that affect the way you rehearse, the way you perform, the way you interact with other performers?
I think if you get bogged down with music technically, it can take away the emotion. I think that a score is there as an outline for you to embellish and paint it yourself. And I think the composers would give you that license.
The thrill was big enough for your father with Doyley Cart.
Yeah.
But when his son is at the Royal College of Music, does he come to watch his son perform?
He did. He came to see me in a number of concerts that I did there. The last time he saw me at the Royal College of Music was at my graduation. And I was sat up on stage. I looked out into the audience and I saw my mother. And then I looked next to her and I saw my father, and he was fast asleep with what we used to call his Fred Flintstone face, because when he used to sleep, he looked like Fred Flintstone. It was really, really funny. But as it happened, he was very poorly. He had a brain tumour, and we didn't know that. It was quite a shock to us all. And,
did he didn't know either.
No,
I mean, he wasn't keeping it from you.
He didn't know. No, he didn't know at all. We were told by the doctors that we'd only have 6 months with him, less than that, you know. And we actually had 10 months with him.
Did you come home from London to spend time with him in that final 10
months?
Yeah,
I used to come home every weekend. So, in fact, I got to spend the last night with him, and also had the luxury and the blessing of being able to hold him while he was dying, which was incredible. It's an amazing thing to experience, because I did feel him go.
Did you?
You know, yeah. He just left. It wasn't my father anymore that I was holding. It was an incredible, incredible thing. And can't believe I'm talking about this on national radio, to be honest. But it's something that's very special to me, that made me, that changed my life, you know, and made me grow up. I grew up a lot. I think it was a real turning point for me. I really became a man, I think. Realised what life was about. It was a very spiritual time, you know. It was a real emotional, very spiritual time. Being present at the death of my father and the birth of my daughter is just an incredible thing to have experienced, you know.
Do you feel you've spoken very vividly about the type of father that your dad was?
Yeah.
Do you feel the sort of legacy?
I do. I mean, there's funny things. You know, my father said to me at one point, he said, when I'm gone, Alf, you know, there'll be a point in your life, and there'll be one day that you'll see me, you know, you'll see me. And I thought, I don't know what you mean by that, and I never knew what he meant by that until it happened. And it's not spooky or anything like that, but I remember it was a simple, simple little thing. I went into the back kitchen and to make a cup of tea, and I picked up the kettle and I looked at my hand, and I'm not kidding, it was my father's hand.
Yeah.
You know, and the way I stirred the tea, it was the way my father did it. And everything I do now, I notice my father in myself, and it took him to die for me to realise that I was his son, you know.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't be as good a person as he was, but, you know, I try and have the same humour, and I give my daughter the same sort of teaching that I had, and moral standards and all that sort of stuff. And it's an incredible thing to experience that, you know.
Let's have some music then. We're on disc number 7, Alfie.
Yeah, this is actually mine and my wife's song. We danced at this at our wedding. Everybody was expecting something really calming and ballady, you know. I suppose this happens to be Led Zeppelin's Rain Song.
Led Zeppelin and the Rain Song, and fabulously, Alfie Bowe, you say that was your song for you and your wife at your wedding.
Yeah.
Now everybody wants to work with you, I understand. But Robert Plant and you were about to.
I've been, fortunate enough, you know, that was Robert singing, and fortunate enough to have the opportunity to do a duet with him. Oh my goodness, he's the rock god, he really is, you know, Robert Plant. So I just can't believe my luck.
So, Alfie Bowe, you went out with Baz Luhrmann to do this production of La Bohème. You were one of the cast who won it, you were awarded a Tony for your performance.
Right.
When you were out in New York, apart from the success with La Boheme, that was where you met your wife.
Yeah, that's right.
Was she working on the same production?
No, Sarah was actually studying in San Francisco. She's an actress.
Right.
Sarah then came to New York with me for the Broadway run. We got married a year later. We've been married for 7 years now, and we've got a little girl, little Gracie.
And you said you were there at the birth of Gracie. Being one of nine then, I can only imagine you're planning to have eight more of your own.
Well, I'd like more children. I like big families, of course, coming from a big family myself, but I suppose it just depends on how lucky we are.
And what about, given how close you were to your dad, what about the fact that he didn't meet your wife and he has never met Gracie?
No.
Yeah.
I do regret that, actually. I do feel a bit sad about that because I know that... The first thing you would have said to Sarah when you met her was, what the hell are you doing with him? That's what he would have said, you know. And I know that he would have loved my little girl so much, and he loved children. So that's one thing my brothers and sisters have over me, is that they've had the chance of taking their kids to see my dad, but not that it's a competition. It's just one of those things.
Surely you can't help but wonder what he might have said to you about this extraordinary career, your albums going into the top 10, all that stuff that happens now for you on a regular basis. What would he have made of that?
I'd like to say I think he would have been proud. You know, I think he would have been proud. He was a bit of a closet performer himself, I think, you know, so he would have lapped it up so much. He would have loved to have been at the parties and had the nice lifestyle of it, you know, he would have liked that.
Does your mother do that? Does she come along to the gigs and parties and first nights?
She doesn't really know, no. She's 78 now. And she'll tell me off for saying that on national radio as well. But she doesn't really travel the way that she used to anymore, and she can't really come to London on her own very well. But she's always tuning in to the radio.
And is she surprised by this huge success, or does she say, you know, I always thought when I saw you there,
She always knew that something had happened, that it'd take off. And I think she's been very proud about the way that I've worked at it.
Let's have your final piece of music then, Alfie Bo. What is it?
This takes me right back to my childhood. It was played so much at home that thinking when you listen to the song, the image of the front living room, the roast dinner, the family around the table. My dad used to sing this as a nighttime song for me, and it's come full circle, so I'm actually singing it for my little girl now, for Gracie. And this is Slim Whitman, Beautiful Dreamer.
Beautiful dreamer, waken to me, starlight and dewdrops are waiting for thee, sounds of the
Slim Whitman and Beautiful Dreamer. So, Alfie Bo, the books then. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Okay, thank you.
And you also get to take a book of your own.
Oh, I think I'd have to take Tropical Recipe Book, cooking-wise.
Yes, we'll find you one of those.
Thank you.
We'll track it down.
100
we'll...
different recipes for coconut.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right,
thank
it's
you.
Yours. And a luxury.
I've thought long and hard about this, and my wife told me, help me along with this, and I was thinking practically a Stanley knife, solar-powered beard trimmer, what can I do? And then I thought, I can't survive without my drum kit.
Ah.
And then I can play as loud as I want and as long as I want without being told to shut up.
You surely can.
Thank you.
The drum kit is yours. And if you had to choose just one of these eight discs, which one disc would you choose to save?
Oh, my goodness. That's tricky. I think if I was sat on a desert island supping coconut milk with my drum kit next to me watching the sunset, I'd probably take Paul Robeson with me.
Okay.
I think
it's yours. Alfie Bo, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.